Hi everybody, welcome back to the Run to the Top podcast. Today on our show we have our guest Sage Kanadeh. Sage is on our show today to talk about trail running and ultra running, and he has quite the experience not only in that but as a traditional runner and marathoner as well. Just to give you a little bit of a background, Sage is a 216 marathoner, and he's qualified for the last two Olympic trials. And I believe in the first time he qualified in New York City, he was the youngest qualifier in that Olympic trials for the marathon. Since then, he's decided to move to ultra running and trail running. And so far, he's had tremendous success. He's the American record holder at the Mount Washington Hill Climb. And he's also the 2012 USA Mountain Running Champion. So if as we talk today, if you want to visit the resources that we mentioned on this podcast or you want to know more about Sage, you can visit runnersconnect.net/RC12, and that'll give you all the details on this podcast. And one more thing, if you like this podcast, please visit iTunes and give us a rating and vote for us and tell us that you like us. It'll help other people find the podcast. And with all that, let's get started and welcome Sage. Hi Sage, welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Awesome. Well, you know, we really appreciate you coming here today and sharing your experience with ultra running and trail running, and also, you know, the experience that you have with transitioning from kind of the more traditional runner. You know, I did a brief introduction with some of your major accomplishments, but, you know, let's give our audience a little bit more in-depth picture of who you are and how you've kind of evolved through the sport from, you know, training probably in high school and then through now doing a lot of ultra running and trail running.
I started running pretty seriously actually in middle school. I was doing track and then by the time I was doing high school, I was doing cross country in the fall, and I really always enjoyed running on the trails. I grew up in Oregon, so there's a lot of opportunities to run out in the woods, run up and down hills, and that's good training for cross country. But I also did the traditional track route, and I went to Cornell University, where I ran for Coach Robert Johnson, and I always was probably more competitive at cross country. It seemed like we were running 8K cross-country races, and I was beating guys that would crush me at 10K, even on the track. So I always liked the hills, and I always liked the challenge of being on uneven terrain, I guess.
But it was a calling from the beginning.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I just, you know, I like running fast too, but it, you know, the hills are always, I think I'm better at running uphill than flat or downhill for sure. So I slowly built my mileage up over those years. I was training year round, and I that's when I first got over 100 miles a week, which is pretty high volume even for Division I college. Mm-hmm. And we did more marathon type training because I convinced my coach to run the marathon that year when I was 21 years old when I qualified for the first trials. And then
so just to make sure our audience knows, you qualified for the Olympic trials and the marathon in 2008 when you were still in college.
Yeah, it was actually 2007, yeah.
Oh, so yeah, right.
I ran my first marathon at Houston over winter break that year, and I missed the standard by 21 seconds, and so I was devastated at first, but then I decided I'd run Grandma's Marathon in June right after track season, and it was really hot that year, but I was able to hold on and qualify with 17 seconds to spare, so that was barely making it.
Nice. But let me interrupt there for a second. How did your training look that spring when you were, I'm assuming, trying to do an NCAA track season, which, you know, involves a lot of speed work, 10K is the longest distance, and then how did you go and run a marathon in June? What did that training look like?
I mean, basically, Robert Johnson at Cornell, his training was more based on marathon-type training, even for the 5K and 10K on the track, so I had that kind of going for me. We still did a lot of track workouts, traditional VO2 max workouts, even like, you know, 200s and 400s for leg turnover. But I always kept my mileage pretty high. And I was doing some, you know, 2-hour long runs probably, but nothing extremely long for marathon specific. But basically, I ran the 10K at conference. I had 5 weeks till the marathon. And in those first couple weeks, I just ramped my mileage up to like 120. I started doing 20-mile long runs, 22-mile long runs pretty hard. I did some back-to-back workouts that would get my legs calloused for the extra distance to go 26.2. So That was the main thing. I had to change right away.
Yeah. No, that's, I mean, that's actually probably a pretty good time period, that 5-week period where you can do some marathon specific work. So it makes sense. Yeah. I was just curious if there was anything, you know, really interesting that you did, because I'm sure there's some people that come off, you know, either doing shorter type races and then want to move to the marathon. So glad it's, you know, they can see that it's possible and obviously to be successful even on a tough day.
Yeah. I mean, generally, like, it seemed like when I moved up in race distance, I got better. So I was just kind of, I knew I had the speed to run the marathon qualifying time. I just needed to get that specific endurance in. And, you know, some people do it the other way. They'll build the endurance first, then add a little bit of speed. And I think you could do both ways, and it'll work out. And then if you get that mix of training stimulus in there. So.
Right. So after college, what did you, you know, where did your running career take you?
I was fortunate enough to be accepted into the Hanson's Brooks distance running project, which I'm sure you're familiar with.
A little bit.
I've run there. There's a lot of really cool guys to run with, actually. Brian Sell was still on the team when I joined, so I got to kind of pick his brain. Clint Barron was still out there. A lot of more, you know, mature guys that had actually run under 2:15 in the marathon. So that was a different training stimulus for me, too, because the overall intensity was a lot higher, and the mileage was consistently higher. And just having so many fast guys that push you every day was a lot different. But I think it helped me eventually become a stronger runner as I matured. But it definitely took a couple years to kind of kick in.
Yeah, it's definitely, there's definitely a long process there sometimes in terms of where you get adapted and you're not just dog tired every day and racing tired. It's tough, but once you adapt, it definitely obviously helps. And so you ran 2:16 while a member of the Hanson's team.
I did, yeah. It was my second year there, 2011, at the Rock and Roll San Diego Marathon. I ran it was 2:16:52. So
it's 2:16 in my book.
Yeah, closer to 2:17. But I also ran a 1:04:32 in the half marathon before that, which, honestly, it was probably my best performance while I was there. And I also ran in the Olympic trials in 2012 for them. And that was right before, that was my last race as a Hanson's Brooks athlete.
Okay. So, you know, kind of moving into the next phase, you know, you're and I kind of know from your background that that's when you started doing more of kind of the trail racing and ultra running. You know, because you were having, you obviously were having a lot of success in the shorter distance, well, quote unquote shorter distances, you know, the half marathon and marathon, you know, what made you kind of make the jump to doing some trail running and ultra running?
I mean, it was always in the back of my mind after, you know, having fun in cross country in college. I still want to go back to the roads and, you know, try to qualify for the trials again in 2016. So it's not like I'm saying no more to the roads at all.
Right, right.
Maybe even try to go back and get a 10K PR on the track. I don't know. But I think the mix is good. And just in training, it's good to have a variety to change things up every couple years. It's a great break mentally. It's a totally different mindset when you're running out on some of the trails. The course is an extra challenge. Just, you know, surviving the course, surviving the extra long distance beyond 26.2, I think will really help me be a stronger runner overall. So I guess the challenge drew me in, and I just wanted to see, you know, how I stacked up and what it felt like.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's obviously you've had success in it, so it was definitely a good decision, you know, obviously in terms of even competitively, you know, you're definitely competitive in that space. But when you first transitioned, you know, how did the training change from, you know, what you were doing in the marathon to, you know, what you're doing to prepare for some of your first ultras and trail races?
Less of a focus on speed work. I haven't touched the track all year. I've done some pretty hard, like, VO2 max efforts, but it involves more like trying to run as fast as I can up a mountain. If anyone in the Boulder area knows of Green Mountain, I've been basically racing up that as some of my harder workouts. So I'll run, you know, 20 or 30 minutes straight uphill at a, you know, 85% maximum heart rate to 100%. Basically at the end, and that's what I consider speed work now. I also have extended my long runs a little bit. When I was at Hanson's, we were limited to just going 20 miles for our long run, and I always felt like I kind of wanted to go farther, because I have before in college, I did some longer runs, and I like the idea of building extra strength by doing like over distance type of training. So I extended my long run up to 28 miles. I got in a good 28 miler before my first 50K trail run, and that was back in March at the Chuckanut. And less emphasis on you know, high intensity paces. So like you're out on the trail running the long run, it's very specific to trail running. You don't really have to worry about what pace you're running. You have to go more by effort and kind of just counting more time on your feet rather than hitting certain mile splits, because the course changes so much and there's so many hills, you get discouraged if you're always looking at your GPS.
Yeah, so that makes sense. So even in the training, that's you're probably doing more mileage overall, and a lot of it's a lot easier, I'm assuming. There's probably maybe one key workout or two key workouts a week.
Yeah, I'd actually even say the mileage isn't higher, it just takes longer to get in, because you know, I'll run 90 miles a week still maybe, but it takes just as long as when I was running 110 or 115 miles a week on the road, just because you're running maybe a minute a mile slower out on the trails. But as long as you're putting in the time, you're still training your aerobic system for, you know, 90 minutes or 2 hours, and I think there's a lot of value in that, so you don't get too caught up in the numbers, kind of. It's more relaxing, actually, I think.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's what I've kind of imagined. Pretty much all the running that you do is on the trail. Is that because you, I mean, it might be both, but is it because you enjoy it more, or is it because that you're trying to be as specific as possible to the race that you're trying to train for?
Definitely both. I'm really fortunate now that I live in Boulder, so there's a whole network of trails. It wasn't quite the same in Michigan, but also the fact that a lot of trails are, it's just softer on your joints. So, you know, if you're running 100% of your miles on the road, it could really beat you up, and you want to kind of change out of your routine, I guess. So I'll mix it up still. I'll go to the roads if I want to do some sort of tempo run, but it's kind of rare these days for me to do that. And there's so many different trails. I mean, you're like, it's usually I'm making up my mind whether or not I want to go up a really big hill or mountain or stay on relatively flat trails, see what I could do. But yeah, I think it's better to train specifically for the type of race you're doing. So if you're doing a trail ultra, you got to spend some time on the trails.
So what about, how do you handle the hills in the training? Like you said, there's sometimes you choose routes based on, you know, how hilly or flat they are. But obviously you're going up and down a lot. You know, how does that factor into, you know, not only the intensity and recovery, but, you know, in terms of the overall planning, like how often do you try to incorporate hills into your training?
Pretty often. It does depend on the race that I'm focusing on. So like a lot of ultra races, I'll study the elevation map and I'll say, okay, this is a 50-mile race. There's 10,000 feet of vertical. Like that's a decent amount of up and down. So in that case, I'm going to be putting in more hilly long runs. I'll do probably at least a 20-miler every weekend that has quite a bit of hills in it. Maybe not 5,000 feet of vertical. That's really hard to get in. But at least some several thousand feet probably of change, and I'll map it out on like Google Earth or something. And yeah, I'd probably try to get that in at least once a week. And just around Boulder, I mean, it's so hilly, it's hard not to run up and down hills. But I think, you know, hills are speed training in disguise, basically. And even going downhills, it works your quads in a different way. So I think doing hills more frequently is actually beneficial to a lot of runners, even people running on the road.
Yeah, so how do you handle the downhills? You know, because I can imagine, like the way I picture it, and again, I don't have a ton of experience with trail running, but, you know, I just picture it being a scary free fall, you know, when you're kind of going down, especially on a trail where, it's, you know, the footing might not be great. You know, kind of how do you handle it physically? You know, are there any tricks that you use? Or and also mentally, you know, how do you kind of get over the fact that you might fall on your ass?
Yeah, oh, definitely. I mean, it depends how technical the trail is, because some trails will be like really rocky, like running down Pike's Peak, for example. A lot of people will fall on that because you trip on a rock when you're getting tired. I generally don't like the downhills.
Okay.
I'm more of an uphill runner, but you definitely have to let loose. You have to take some risks. A lot of it comes down to how much of a risk you're willing to take, how much blood you want to leave out on the course. And sometimes, depending on what stage, at what point you are in the race, you don't necessarily want to fly on the downhills because that might come back later and bite you. Like a lot of people who've run the Boston Marathon, for example, know that you don't go as fast as you can on the first 10K downhill because it'll beat up your quads. So mm-hmm. it's not always about speed on the downhills. It's about being consistent and steady, not falling. In my first ultra, I ended up getting 5 stitches
wow.
from falling. So it's definitely a risky thing that keeps you on your toes.
Yeah. So you feel like you've improved over time? Because I guess I see it the way you just described it as probably like the Tour de France guys. When, you know, I watch them on TV, I'm like, those guys are nuts. You know, they're flying, when they go down the hills, they're just flying and taking those corners. But, you know, they've obviously had years of experience. And do you feel like at this point you've kind of developed that experience over time and with patience?
Definitely a little bit. I'm still learning a lot, especially about technical trails and downhill. But it's definitely a skill that I think that with the more experience you have, the better you get at it. There is some natural ability involved. Like I think I'm naturally better at going uphill mm-hmm. rather than downhill, and it's
right.
kind of a trade-off. But it's definitely something that if you work on it, you could improve a lot, both ups and downs, and the technical trail aspect. And having proper footwear also helps, mm-hmm. I've found, too.
Yeah, you know what, let's actually get into that. So we had some user questions, and for those listening, you know, we post on our social media, on our Facebook and Twitter. You can follow us. We post when we have guests, and so we had actually some guests or some of our audience members post some questions, and a lot of them were actually focused around shoes and what you're trying to choose to wear. So let's talk about that a little bit. You know, how do you, when you're approaching a race, how do you decide what shoe to wear? And actually, we can probably tell your story of what happened recently, because I think it's at your last race, because I think it's a good lesson for that you've learned and that you can probably teach to our audience.
Yeah, I definitely recommend trail shoes are usually quite a bit different from road shoes, but I'll take a couple different shoes to a race, and depending on whether or not I've seen the course ahead of time, I'll make a decision there. And shoe selection is really important. So I was in San Francisco at the North Face 50 this weekend, and there was a big storm coming in. It was raining at least like an inch an hour at times, and we were running on these fire roads that I thought drained pretty well, but I found out in the second half of the race that everyone's footprints had made it pretty muddy. It got flooded. It was like a slip and slide going up and down the hills. And unfortunately, I chose to wear my lightweight road racing flats. I'm fortunate enough to be sponsored by Scott Sports, and I was wearing this pretty lightweight, it's 6.5 ounce road racing flat. Basically, it's great on the roads. It'd be great for a marathon. It was great for the first 20 miles of the race, but once I hit those muddy hills, I was slipping all over the place. Mm-hmm. And it's really unfortunate because actually, Scott had just sent me this new trail shoe, the TC2, and it has pretty good lugs on the bottom.
Like, okay,
it's really good traction, and I had these with me. And they're all muddy because I was wearing them around at the start. It was my mistake. It was kind of a bad error on my part mm-hmm. to choose to not go with this shoe and instead go with my road racing flat. And I think it cost me a lot of energy out on the course. And I definitely fell a lot and was bleeding a lot. So shoe is, you know, your choice of shoes is critical. Mm-hmm. And it's good to give yourself options. Try to study the course. Ideally, you'd know kind of what the most technical parts of the course are, because that's a huge factor in ultra races is, you know, what if there's rocks or if there's mud or if it's you have water crossings maybe or, mm-hmm. you know, what the hills are like. And sometimes it's hard to gauge.
Yeah, so I guess I have two follow-up questions. I guess the first, would you say it's fair to say that the lesson that you learned is maybe be more err on the side of wearing a trail shoe as opposed to a more traditional running shoe? Would you say that might be the lesson you learned, or maybe not? Maybe I'm off.
Definitely. Err on the side of sacrificing a little bit of weight maybe for extra traction.
Mm-hmm.
That was the main thing. I was lighter's not always better, because if you're losing traction, you've already kind of that energy cost has already come back to get you. So yeah, it's always better to have something that has better traction than something that doesn't. And usually the shoes with better traction do weigh a little bit more.
Mm-hmm.
But it's something you got to experiment around with, and I didn't put in the time before the race. It's kind of a last minute thing, so you definitely want to do your research on that.
Okay. I mean, that makes. I mean, I don't have quite as much experience, but I'm relating it to cross country when you choose your spike size, you know, before the race, when you say like, oh, am I going to go with a short spike or a long spike? And, you know, sometimes you make a mistake and pick a short one and the course is really muddy and it doesn't work out, but it's not 50 miles, so it's over a little before it really gets bad.
Everything gets magnified.
Yeah. And I guess actually the second question is, I was curious about this and somebody asked about this is, do you ever have an option where you'll carry another extra pair of shoes with you? So, for example, at this race, you know, the first 20 miles were relatively easy or better terrain, and then switching to a more traditional trail shoe. Have you ever tried that or know people that have?
Oh, definitely. Yeah, that's actually a great strategy. In a lot of ultras, they call them you having a drop bag. So at some of the aid stations in the middle of the race, you could have a bag set aside with your number or your name on it, and you'll throw in an extra jacket, you'll throw in an extra pair of shoes, and so a lot of people stop at aid stations and they'll be able to switch shoes, which is honestly what I should have done. I actually had some help, my parents were there watching, they could have, I could have changed, but I didn't think about it at the time. I was really trying to open up a gap on the field, and every minute was critical, so I didn't stop and do that. But when I look back on it now, I definitely should have. And I definitely should have gotten my jacket out, too, because I started getting really cold.
Okay.
Yeah, if you do an ultra and you get a drop bag, I definitely take advantage of it. Put extra clothes, extra shoes, even extra food, gels in it, too, because it can make a huge difference later on.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, so in that sense, it sounds like, you know, with the trail running and ultra running that you're doing, it sounds like the preparation and kind of getting all the details right is definitely a lot more important and something you have to put a lot more time into than a normal race. Are there any lessons or, I guess, strategies that you've picked up over the last couple of months of things that you that can help you, like the drop bag, those types of things?
Oh, yeah, definitely. You got to study, like, the race will come out with a list of what they provide at the aid stations.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, at this race, they weren't handing out any gels, which is rare because usually they hand out gels at aid stations. So I knew that I had to stuff a bunch more in my pockets, basically. But they also had other things like candy bars and potato chips and peanut butter and jelly sandwiches. So you got to kind of figure out what, you know, you're going to eat out there on the course, what works well for you. And you could do that in training on your long runs ahead of time, figure out whether you like to eat potato chips during a run or you want to take salt tablets instead.
Mm-hmm.
And also studying the elevation map of a course, I think, is really critical because that'll determine how I do my long runs, how I do my hill training. Because if it's got a lot of up and down, then you have to be ready for that, or your legs are going to protest a lot when you get out there. So
yeah.
Just studying the course map too, I'd say. Like a lot of these trail runs, I've had the misfortune of getting lost, which isn't good. So it's good to study the map, too, and see where the major turns are, kind of mm-hmm. figure out where you're going in the race.
Mm-hmm. Now, I have a question. And for those who don't know, Sage was talking about the race that he ran last weekend, and you happened to go off course at one point. Did you feel like you adequately looked at the trail map before the race, or were you kind of – did you feel like that was a mistake that you made?
Well, in this case, it was kind of a special circumstance because of the weather, they actually changed the course the day before the race.
I see.
So I've been studying this trail map for weeks and weeks and weeks. because of all the flooding, they had to totally redo the course. And so they came out with a map the day before, which I did study, but this race also started in the dark. It started at 5 a.m., and the part where we got lost was about an hour and a half in, and it was still basically pitch black out.
Mm-hmm.
And I was in the lead with two other guys. I was in second place with two other guys. And, you know, honestly, we didn't even see there was a fork in the trail, but we didn't even look off to see the fork. Mm-hmm. It was a part where the course overlaps, and it was kind of confusing. And it when you're in the dark, it's really hard.
Yeah, I can imagine.
So that was kind of a special case, I think. Usually it's not like that. Usually it's not raining really hard and dark, and you know, if you're in the lead, it's sometimes harder to route find Because I think they're supposed to be a volunteer at that intersection, and they hadn't gotten there yet. So
okay.
That was kind of part of the problem. But yeah, you definitely want to study the map ahead of time and hope they don't change it last minute.
Yeah, well, I mean, I guess that's probably part of the extra challenge that goes along with these types of races is, you know, those types of things can happen. You know, they're not going to change a marathon course, you know, too much at least. And, you know, you never know, I guess, what could happen. But let's actually move on to something that you talked about just previously with, you know, kind of the fueling and those that type of thing. You know, obviously you're running for a significantly longer time than you would for even a marathon. You know, how does your approach to fueling change at that point when you're going to be out there for, you know, probably twice as long as a marathon, maybe longer than that?
It changes a lot. You have to eat a lot more. One of my friends say, you know, a 50-mile ultra is like an eating contest for 50 miles. Because you basically, you want to take in quite a bit of carbs, and you also want to take in some electrolytes, some sodium, to help kind of ward off the cramps. So depending on the weather, depending on how much you're sweating, that could also change a lot. But general rule of thumb, you're going to start needing probably about 200, maybe 300 calories an hour out there, which is a lot.
That is a lot.
Yeah, I'll be taking 3 gels an hour, sometimes more. And then sometimes I'll switch from drinking Gatorade to just drinking straight Coke at the aid stations. And it's really critical in ultras, because if you bonk, it's going to get really bad.
Right.
If you have 10 or 20 miles to go and you're bonking, then it's hard to pull out of that. And so you try to keep your blood sugar as level as possible. And if you didn't take anything, it would be like running a marathon, and you'd be hitting the wall, you know, between 20 and 25 miles. And just the energy cost of going up hills too, you have to take into account too. So a lot of people take a lot of gels. Some people eat solid bars.
So what's your, you still do the gels. I would feel personally that taking 3 gels an hour, like I would start getting pretty sick of them after just an hour, and I have 3 or 4 more hours to go. But the gels kind of work for you, or?
Yeah, well, they have, for the most part. I'll change it up, and it really depends on the race, because sometimes they'll have aid stations every 4 miles, sometimes it's every 8 miles, and so you could load up on gels at each station. You stop there, and you could take some, and when I start getting sick of the sugar, because it is pretty sweet, sometimes I'll grab a handful of potato chips, which I did in a couple races that worked out well for me, and I think having that sodium in there also helps. And you get some sodium from the Coke and the Gatorade, but the chips tasted good. I think the fat tasted good. But I definitely know people that have taken, like Max King, for example. He took a couple hammer bars during a 100K race that we did, and that seemed to really help him. But it's a fine balance, because sometimes your stomach doesn't feel real good, but you know you have to keep eating or you're going to bonk.
Right.
So it's something you want to, you know, practice in your long runs and training. A lot of people, most people carry either a handheld bottle or like a Camelback type of hydration system with them. So I'll carry a 20-ounce handheld in my hand, and it'll be full of Coke, and I'll be sipping on that between aid stations, and then I'll fill it up. Because you always want to get that constant flow of energy, and it's a lot more critical than a road marathon, just because you're out there for so long.
Right. What about, you know, you kind of mentioned it briefly with potato chips. What about taking, like, protein and maybe even a little bit of fat? Like, have you experimented or know people that have used protein and included that, and how has that worked?
Definitely. I think for the longer ultras, especially, like, 100K to 100 miles, it becomes even more critical to eat all sorts of things that have a lot of protein and fat in them. Generally, I've kind of stayed away from a whole lot of protein. I know some of the gels, I think the Roctane, have some amino acids in them.
Right.
And I've taken a lot of those, so I think that definitely helps a little bit. And it kind of depends how long you're going to be out there. And like I said, the potato chips, I'm not sure if it's the salt or the fat that tasted good, but you definitely are burning a lot of fat too. And
right.
So to utilize fat as a fuel is going to make it more efficient for your glycogen stores too, so probably taking in some fat is good too eventually, depending on for the longer the race, I'd say.
Yeah, and I know probably the question answer to this question is going to be something along the lines of, you know, you enjoy doing it, but, you know, one of the things that I've always wondered, and I think others do as well, is, you know, how do you power through those days and those days that you don't want to be out training, and obviously you have to be out there for a long run, and it's not just an hour or 90 minutes, it's 3 hours or so. And, you know, not only those days, but then those bad runs that you're just kind of like, man, not feeling it today, and you got a long way to go. You know, how do you deal with those, you know, as an ultra trail runner when it's usually significantly longer than it would be for a normal type of race?
I mean, I view it as a challenge. It's always good to make yourself more mentally tough. And if I'm struggling in training, I'll think about it like I would in a race, and I'll be like, well, the race is going to be a challenge too. It's going to be tough. There's going to be some spots where you don't feel good. And that's, you know, you just have to try to work through it and stay motivated by focusing on little goals, like little races building up to a big race, or thinking about how tough the competition is going to be and how much tougher this makes me because I overcame this training run or this obstacle. But, you know, I mean, everyone's out there working hard and training as hard as they can, so you got to be competitive and push yourself out of your comfort zone quite a bit.
Yeah, that makes sense. So let's talk about some of your training and workouts. You know, what do you consider to be some of your key workouts that you enjoy doing, and that you also feel like when you're done with them, you're set. You know, you can say to yourself, you know, that I'm fit. You know, that was a good day.
Mainly for ultras, it's the long run, and I'll do usually a 28 miler as my go-to distance, and if I run that at a really good clip, I know I'm in shape, depending on the course. But also just doing my efforts up Green Mountain, I did a lot of treadmill workouts actually.
Okay.
For Mount Washington, and I'll do like the Runner's World Uphill Challenge. Actually, it's Trail Runners Uphill Challenge, which is 15 minutes at 15% incline on a treadmill.
Wow.
And you try to go as far as you can in distance. So you kind of set the pace. You could adjust the pace as you go, but it's a 15% incline.
That's like straight up.
My treadmill. And it's like a good like VO2 max test. And I remember I did that before Mount Washington, and I did 1.99 miles, which I felt really confident after that. So that's a good barometer of my fitness too. So I'll run on the treadmill sometimes.
Yeah, I was curious about that actually, because somebody asked that question. They asked, you know, what treadmill workouts did you do in preparation for Mount Washington? And I actually responded, I don't think Sage runs on the treadmill. But obviously you do. And so that was kind of one of your key workouts before that race.
It was, yeah, definitely. I did that 3 weeks before. Yeah.
Cool. So, you know, let's say that somebody is, you know, one of their goals maybe for the new year upcoming is to maybe do a trail race coming off, you know, traditionally training for marathon, half marathon, that kind of thing. You know, how do you think that they should, transition, you know, what kind of things that they should do to get prepared for that?
It depends if they're going like a 50K, you mean 50K?
Yeah, I would say 50K, because I would imagine that's a pretty good introduction into ultra / trail running, because going 100 mile your first time is probably not the smartest decision.
Yeah, I know some people that have done it, but
I'm sure there are.
50K is good, you know, 31 miles. It still takes a lot longer than a road marathon, depending on the course. But, you know, the main thing I'd suggest is train a lot, kind of like a marathon, but with less emphasis on any track workouts, VO2 max workouts, and more emphasis on the long run. And more emphasis on trying to get out on the trails. If you have some trails, you definitely want to get used to running on the trails more. Get some hills in there too. Do some more hill workouts. But it does depend on the course, but I think hills will make you stronger just to cover the extra distance. Mm-hmm. So I'd incorporate more hilly long runs, maybe uphill tempo runs is the workouts that I like to do, like the treadmill workout I mentioned basically.
Yep.
And then just, you know, not worrying about crushing every easy pace run, not worrying about pace as much, just kind of having that mindset that you want to spend time on your feet, and then kind of dial in your nutrition plan too.
Mm-hmm.
That would be the big differences. Maybe get some trail shoes for that.
Um, You know, one of the things that that I've done with athletes that I coach who want to do, you know, specifically the 50K distance, is one of the things that we'll do is kind of do back-to-back long runs, and not necessarily full long runs, you know, not 220 milers, but, you know, do something where they do maybe 14 on a Saturday and maybe 18 or 20 on a Sunday. Have you ever done something like that, and have you found it to be effective?
I have, actually. Yeah, I usually am too tired after like a 28 miler to go out and do a 20 the next day.
Right, but well, 28 is pretty far.
Yeah, I'll still try to put in, you know, a good 15 miler maybe the next day. And I'm actually really agree with that school of thought where you know, especially for people that work 9 to 5 Monday through Friday, you might as well, you want to hit it really hard on the weekend. So you get in a big weekend, like maybe you put in 30 miles on a weekend over 2 days. So I'm definitely in having your, you know, two hard days be really hard and then having some easy days really easy. So you get more of a, there's more of an extreme change between your really high mileage days and then your really easy days. Because maybe, you know, I'll do a 30 miler one day, but then I'll, 2 days later, I'll just do like a 5 miler to totally recover from that. So
right.
It's definitely a bigger swing in how your long runs are really long and then you're relax and try to recover between them.
Right. No, that makes a lot of sense. And from what it sounds like, that's actually probably the biggest difference between like probably optimal marathon training, in the sense that, you know, the consistency is more important than any one or two big workouts. Whereas it sounds like, I mean, consistency is certainly important, but, you know, it's a little bit easier to just say, you know, I'm going to get these big weekends in and maybe one or two big workouts and just kind of fill in the rest. Is that probably a fair assessment?
Yeah, definitely. The overall moderate intensity doesn't need to be there as much as it does in road marathoning. But, I mean, generally, the higher the mileage you could average out, the better
right.
you'll be doing in the ultra, too.
Right, of course.
But, you know,
obviously, you're running a lot.
Yeah, that is a difference, though, for sure.
Yeah. So, you know, let's talk a little bit about kind of the you know, kind of how you go about things. You know, talk about, you know, some of the sponsors and the how you're going about, you know, training for these races.
Oh, yeah, I've actually been really fortunate. Recently, I got on board with Scott Sports. It's my major gear sponsor, shoe sponsor, and they've really helped me out a lot. They make a lot of shoes, actually, for trail runs, mountain running, because they're European-based, but also for, like, triathletes and road marathons, too. So everyone should check them out. And then
we'll throw up a link on this at the end of this podcast, or we'll throw up a link, again, runnersconnect.net/RC12. Check that out, and you'll see the links for everything Sage is talking about here.
That'd be great. And then a local company, Ultimate Direction, based out of Boulder, they're my hydration gear sponsors. So they give me a lot of my handheld 20-ounce fluid bottles, and then they also have backpacks, hydration vests that you could wear on these longer races that you fill up with gels. There's a gel pouch I have from them. Really great, innovative products. And that always helps because you want to carry gels with you for sure on the run. And then my nutrition sponsor, Flora Health, Udo's Oil, which is actually, Udo's Oil gives you all these omega-3s. So it's a lot of fatty acids that, you know, I mix into my salad dressing. And I know Max King's another sponsored athlete with them. He says it really helps with his fat-burning capacities.
Okay.
So it's important to take in your fats, eat some fats, eat some omega-3s. When you're training too.
Yeah.
And then Smith Optics for my sunglasses, because it's really sunny out here in Boulder.
Yeah.
So
what is it, something 300 sunny days a year or something to that effect?
Yeah, it's sunny every day, which is great. Coming from Oregon, it was like raining every day.
Right,
so
it's a complete opposite, 300 days of rain.
It's the sun for my vitamin D synthesis.
Yeah. Nice. Actually, before we go, let's talk a little bit about your nutrition in training, like on a daily basis. You know, kind of how does that look? I mean, you know, I remember when I was training for the marathon, I was eating like a fiend. I mean, I remember when I was living in the Bloomer House at Hanson's, I remember waking up from a nap and I had lunch and I, you know, slept maybe from like 1 to 2 or 1 to 3, and I got up and I had an entire box of Cocoa Puffs because I was like starving and I just needed chocolate. And I just ate a whole box of Cocoa Puffs, and then I had dinner like an hour later. But you know, what's your nutrition look like in training?
I do eat a lot of carbs. I'm very carb-based. I eat a lot of pasta, a lot of pizza. But I cook for myself a lot. I'll make homemade pizza, actually. I just did the other night. And pasta is always easy to make, especially if you're tired late.
Right.
And I've been a vegetarian my whole life.
Okay. So
that's probably a little bit unusual for an endurance athlete. I know some other ultra runners that are too. So I do take iron supplements, and I get my blood checked to make sure I get enough iron, B12. I'll take B12 supplements, vitamin D. The sun helps with that, I think. Mm-hmm. And I also try to, after I do a long run, I'll try to eat as soon as possible too, because, you know, they say there's that 15-minute window where you want to take in quite a bit of carbs, a little bit of protein.
Right.
And I'll start taking in more protein after a long effort, because I know my muscles need to rebuild. So I'll eat a lot of omelets, eggs, try to eat a lot of salads and fruits too. Just try to eat pretty healthy overall, not a whole bowl of Cocoa Puffs. I'll indulge in some beer, maybe, or ice cream every now and then. So it's always good to mix it up, and you get to eat quite a bit more because you do burn those calories, so it's nice.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting that you said you eat a lot of carbs because, you know, one of the things that I guess maybe there's a, you know, conception that I have of ultra runners and trail runners that they're all on, like, the paleo diet and, you know, just eating protein and natural. You know, how do you feel? Do you feel like you ever kind of are persuaded to go that direction just because of the community that you're a part of with the trail running?
They're not going to persuade me. I'd have to persuade myself. But, yeah, no, I do know a lot of people. A lot of people are, you know, gluten intolerant too, so they do have to stay away from so many carbs.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want to always carbo load before every long run, because I think there's something to be said about kind of going into a long run empty and,
right, absolutely, kind of
burning more fat as you progress along. But no, I really like the taste of pizza and pasta. It's going to be hard to give that up, but I think, you know, just moderation and variety is the key, so.
Yeah. So, you know, before we let you go, I know you do two things on your own as well. You have a company, VO2 Max Productions. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, basically, VO2 Max Productions is my media outlet. I do coaching services off of it. It's a platform to sell my book, Running for the Hansons. So I used it as a publisher to distribute that.
Mm-hmm.
And then we also have a YouTube channel, VO2 Max Productions YouTube channel, which I post a lot of videos from races to training advice, my mountain explorations. it all helps me because I do get some income off of the ads on there and through selling my book and coaching. So.
Cool. Yeah, so we'll throw up a link at the end of this at the end of this podcast again, or sorry, on the page for this podcast to check it out, because I think, you know, if you're looking into doing some ultra running, I think Sage is probably a great person to get some coaching from. You know, and even if you're not, if you're just looking for some coaching, Sage is, you know, he knows what he's talking about. And also, you know, if you're really into trail running and ultra running, you can check out you know, the videos that he posts, and he does some shoe reviews and gear reviews and things like that. So definitely something to check out there. Sage, I want to thank you for taking the time out of your day to give us such an in-depth interview and share your training and your, you know, everything that you've learned with us. We really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you so much for having me on the show. It's an honor.
Awesome. Well, good luck with all your races.
All right. Thanks.
Yep.